Brendan O'Connor on RTE Radio 1 with Allcare Pharmacy. Get expert advice from your friendly healthcare team at Allcare Pharmacy, Ireland's largest community pharmacy network.
Good morning. You're very welcome to the show. Let's start with a look at the Bank Holiday Sunday front pages. And listen, not since 1898, when the Skibbereen Eagle told the Tsar of Russia they were keeping an eye on him, have the Irish newspapers been so obsessed with a Tsar. So the Sunday Independent: Minister digs in on housing Tsar plan with new names in frame. So they're talking here about the LDA head, John Coleman. He's currently on a salary of 200,000. And there's even mention of Robert Watt, who is the Department of Health Secretary General. He's currently, as everybody knows, on over 300,000. The Sunday Times has the kind of a timeline of events, because I think people are still confused as to what exactly happened and who did what. So they are saying NAMA boss lined up as housing czar weeks ago. He was first touted for the role, Brendan McDonagh, this is, 6 weeks ago, according to this story by Jennifer Bray. Pascal Donoghue raised concerns about McDonagh's pay during a call with James Brown, the housing minister, on April 18th. But a note of the call seen by the Sunday Times, according to Jennifer Bray, also states that Donoghue was supportive of the proposed secondment. They also have a story at the top of the front page there. I hope you suffer slow agonising deaths. Kneecap reveal wave of hate mail. The Business Post has gone with it. They have this big special investigation, and it's basically into the amount of, we hear about IP, which is intellectual property. I guess that can mean anything from Coca-Cola brand names and formulas to drug formulas to obviously IT stuff, and they are intangible assets, and there is $1 trillion or so dollars of them being held here in Ireland. They are calling it Ireland's tax mirage. The Irish Mail on Sunday, they're going with 50,000 homes a week hit by power cuts. And they have revealing that in an investigation. They seem to have had to put in a lot of work to get that information. And the Sunday Mirror is reading with tragic and cruel. So this is dozens of undocumented Irish. This story's in other papers as well. Have been quietly rounded up and deported out of America in recent weeks. This is according to a top New York lawyer, Brian O'Dwyer, who works with the Irish community over there. There's a thing called deferred action where you get... You are not legal, but you kind of get, you call in and present yourself in a probation style now and again. He is claiming that when people are going in to present themselves periodically, as they do, that they are being handcuffed and taken away. Okay, our panel this morning: Dan Mulhall is a former Irish ambassador to the US. Professor Niamh Horrigan is Vice President of Academic Affairs at Mary Immaculate College. Pat Leahy is Political Editor of the Irish Times. And Dr. Mirren Lynch is a Senior Research Officer with the ESRI. And good morning, everybody, and thank you for coming in on your bank holiday. Pat Leahy, will you tell us what happened here? Because, was it about the salary? Or we're being told it was because the minister went on the News at One on Wednesday. And Wednesday and said he was the preferred candidate. Simon Harris on The Late Late the other night talked about the right mix of skills, which seems like a euphemism for him saying that they didn't think Brendan McDonagh was the right man for the job. What was the actual reason for what played out this week, or was it purely like coalition politics?
So there's an awful lot in the papers today about this, both about what happened over recent weeks, which culminated in it this week. And there's a fair degree of consensus as to the timeline of events, as it were. Sunday Times in particular lays it out in good detail. There's less consensus on actually why things happened or what it means. What does seem to be certainly the case, and this is borne out by our own reporting in the Irish Times as well, is that the name of Brendan wasn't that wasn't a surprise this week. That had been around for some period, Brendan McDonagh. That had been around for some period of time. It was reported several weeks ago in the Business Post that he was amongst the names being considered. There had been discussions behind the scenes.
He's the only name being mentioned for weeks. Yeah.
Including with Pascal Donoghue. What seems to have happened this week is that worry over within government, particularly within Fine Gael, of how the politics of appointing somebody with a salary of 430,000 was going to work. And this was reached a sort of a fever pitch within Fine Gael, at the top of Fine Gael, after James Brown went on the radio on Wednesday at lunchtime and said that he was the preferred candidate.
Now the leaders have discussed. So the salary was the primary wobble in Fine Gael then?
Now, what you've talked to people in Fianna Fáil, and what they would say is that it was widely known or widely accepted that there was that the salary wasn't going to transfer, that there would have been a different, albeit also very high salary. There's a bit of confusion about that. The objections in Fine Gael were ostensibly on the grounds of process. How is this guy actually going to be selected? And on the salary. I think, boil those down, and it comes down to just how the thing looks politically. And I spoke to somebody about this during the week, and their view, and I think it's the correct one, was that the only thing that people would remember about this guy was that he was paid 400 grand or 430 grand a year. And the politics of that, whilst housing was going to continue to be an escalating problem for the coalition, were toxic, and they wanted to stop that. And so when they were going to stop that, there was also an issue of being seen, Fine Gael being seen to be the ones who stopped it. And once that decision was made, that was certainly the case of what Fine Gael wanted to do, to show that they stopped it. So they briefed then after the cabinet committee.
Can I ask you a question? Up to say Wednesday night, were you being told by anyone in Fianna Fáil you spoke to, this is going ahead, this is going ahead? And were you being told by anyone in Fine Gael you spoke to, this is not going ahead, this is not going ahead? Because that's the experience of, I know that was the experience people were having.
Yeah, so I think things changed on the Wednesday when James Brown came out and said it, said that he was the preferred candidate in the interview. And actually, some people in Fianna Fáil would even agree with that.
Okay. Niamh, before I get on to other pieces, you picked a piece, Star Wars, in the Sunday Times.
Yeah.
But just your general
I think, to be fair, the row about the appointments process and about the salary actually misses the point in some way. So the origins of this idea, Brendan, are actually in the Housing Commission reports. Mm-hmm. There's been huge criticism of the government because they ignored the Housing Commission report in the programme from government largely. And what the Housing Commission report said is they recommended the establishment of a housing delivery oversight executive in legislation as a decision-making body responsible for coordinating the delivery of housing. This body should be time limited. It should identify and address blockages in housing delivery and oversee and drive investment in public utilities and land zoned for housing. So the whole point of a czar and a czar's office is that they have power.
It was going to be legislation.
Real meaning from legislative power.
The government was saying
because
there was no time to put legislation around.
Every single
this.
Agency that this person will be dealing with has power in legislation and in law. And if you don't underpin what this person is doing by equivalent or at least measuring or matching
power,
I
think we're jumping
it's
ahead.
Pointless.
Yeah, okay.
It's optics.
Okay.
And I suppose that's the big issue, is that putting this appointment in place without giving this person any heft at all in real terms will not solve any of the problems that it was designed
okay.
to solve.
Okay, and Marin, we'll come back to that in a minute, but in terms of just what happened this week, because this was the political story of the week, we can talk about whether a czar be any good or not in a minute. Is Pat right that, like, no matter what Brendan McDonagh did, that the 430 grand was toxic?
I mean, it certainly seems to be the case, and that's in some ways, there are all sorts of reasons why you might want to appoint a housing czar and all sorts of reasons why you might not. But to me, the euro amount that they get paid should be very far down the list of reasons to appoint or not appoint, and to
Why?
Appoint or not appoint a particular person. Well, because if someone's going to do a bad job, you don't want them there no matter what they're being paid. But on the other hand, if someone's going to do a good job, then you want to make sure that you pay whatever's necessary to get them there. Now, that's not to say that salary is not important, not in the slightest. But it's kind of frustrating
when you consider the massive problems
we have, this seems to have come a cropper over political infighting and salaries. But I totally understand why it did.
Yeah. I mean, people have been making the point that he would have been paid like, you know, the guts of twice of what the actual minister, who is the ultimate housing czar, you could say, was being paid.
Well, let me tell you, you could offer me 5 million to do that job and I wouldn't touch it. Mm-hmm. I wouldn't go near it. And now I'd be useless at it as well. Okay. But I suppose that for me, the question is,
like,
what
I kind
do we
of
need?
Think, though, that if someone is earning 430 grand in the private sector, right, they're at a level in a job where there are what people call deliverables, right, mm-hmm. where there'd be things he'd have to do. And if he doesn't do them, if he or she doesn't do them, they're gone overnight. That's the nature of jobs that get 500,000. Like, your head rolls. But in the public sector, like, does anyone ever get fired? Do people get shunted around to different jobs and everything? Is it a completely different ballgame to be paying someone 430 grand? He's been earning this in NAMA for years.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think the difference is, Brendan, that in NAMA, you're dealing with a vast amount of state money, right? And you're competing with private sector banks who can pay very high salaries. Therefore, you can understand why 430,000 was set as the figure for that job. The trouble is, this is a different type of job, and it's more difficult to justify paying 430,000 for a job that's not competing with big bank jobs, or it's not handling, you know, billions and billions of state resources. So that's what. But I think it's a shame that this issue of housing, which is the number one issue on people's agenda, and a lot of Irish people are disenchanted because they feel that they are being deprived of their birthright of owning their own home and so on. And it's a shame that this issue has become bogged down not in the delivery but in the personnel being appointed to do the job.
Is it a shame or is it incompetence by the government?
Well, I just think it's unfortunate. We should be getting on with dealing with the housing problem, because if we don't deal with it, we'll end up having bigger political problems, in my view, in the future.
It's unfortunate, but you're kind of using the Breher Sayre again. Like, it's unfortunate. but like, was it a massive cock-up then, that this very important job...
Well, if you look at the Business Post this week, Brendan, they have a whole page on the leaders of semi-state organisations. Every single one of them went through a public appointment service. All of them earn under 300,000, and a share of them earn under 200,000. There's no credible reason why housing czar, whatever about the salary, should not go through a public appointments process. We have a very robust public appointment service. There's no credible reason why that shouldn't happen.
The reason it didn't happen was because they want to get things moving as quick as possible. Government wants to get things moving as quick as possible. You go to the public appointment service and, you know,
yeah, so in the world, could you know, do it in 2 months.
To that, Pat, then, the front of the Sunday Indo today, the fact that they, I think we were led to believe then, okay, this is going to now go through the public appointment service and it'll be yonks before we see someone. Now they seem to be punting more names. Is the minister, would you read into that the minister is doubling down here and thinking, no, we're just going to get someone who's handy from somewhere else?
I think that there will be further conversations in government about the process, and something will have to be a lot more regulated, like something like the public appointments service. But to me, this tells us, this whole thing, and it is, yeah, I think it's a screw up. It's the political management of it has been a screw up all week. But it tells me two more important things. You know, do government, you know, trip over themselves politically from time to time? Is there a controversy of the week? That happens all the time. But often in politics, I think when trying to make sense of it, it helps to try and figure out, you know, what it means. What's the signal amidst all the noise? And this tells me two things. It tells me that relations within government between Fianna Fáil and Fine Gael are not good. At the top, there is little sense of coherence or of a shared mission going on at the moment. And the second, perhaps more important thing it tells me about it is that the government is completely at sea on housing. Mm-hmm. It's a form of magical thinking to believe that if we get one guy in and paying 400 grand, that the housing problem will be solved. And that's kind of the shorthand to what's going on.
But what they would say to that is like that there is no massive big bang solution. It is a patchwork of smaller solutions, and that this could have been one thing that could have possibly sped things up in some way.
And now, because of poor political management, this is delayed. A couple of other things. There's in one of the papers again today, and I think it's the Sunday Times, they're talking about reform of the rent pressure zones. Now, that was something that was flagged at the very start of the government. Something else that was flagged at the start of the government is the possible introduction of tax incentives to stimulate private
sector
development.
But a minister can do all of those things, Pat.
They can do all of those things.
I mean, we have a highly centralised system where we have so much power located in cabinet compared to other European countries, compared to other countries globally. Ministers have enormous power in our system.
Stephen Donnelly was in here with me after he finished up in politics, and I asked him what is the one thing he would tell his replacement as Minister for Health. And he said it is the one piece of advice. He said it is that as the minister, you have the power. You can make things happen.
And we have seen over the years ministers with real vision do things,
but
to be fair.
That requires ministers to push the system. The system on its own needs to
move.
Be pushed. And I guess part of the
is the
idea
system
of
in this country like completely tied up in sclerosis at this stage?
Well, certainly on the planning side of things, it just seems that there's an awful lot of different state bodies that you have to deal with in order to get anything done. And we've looked at this on the energy side, and we're hearing the same thing from colleagues in housing and that kind of thing. And also from speaking to colleagues in other European countries, it's just not, their eyes glaze over when they hear the number of hoops you have to jump through in Ireland to do something like build a wind farm or get a grid connection or something like that. That element of the system certainly seems to be a huge blockage to getting large infrastructural projects built and housing built as well. Kind of when it comes to things like the systems within the civil service or whatever, bureaucracy, you know, that personality can, you know, all of these kind of things, you can't really kind of point to a regulation that says, oh, here's the blockage that we need to get rid of. But it certainly is the case that ministers can make things happen. But there are all sorts of constraints on ministers as well, and you know, you have to weigh up all the different considerations. So
Dan, you've dealt with the system now down the years. Have we put layers and layers on top of everything? We kind of did it in health with putting different layers here and there, getting rid of health boards, HSE, this and that. And we never seem to get rid of the previous layers.
In the 40 years I spent in the public service, certainly government became more complex, it became larger, it became more sophisticated in many ways, but also maybe more deliberative, looking at all angles and so forth. I mean, in the past, I guess, in a situation like this, a strong minister backed by a powerful Secretary General would have driven this agenda through quickly. I mean, imagine if we had Ken Whittaker, for example, around at the moment, give him the job. We don't have one at the moment, maybe, but maybe we do. Maybe we do. Maybe we're to find the right person.
We have a Robert Watt, according to the front of the Sunday Indo, who could be in the frame to be the housing czar. Niamh, going back to what Pat was saying about what this tells us about the government, you picked a piece by Shane Coleman in the Business Post there. He's saying reactive government left with a lot to prove after the first 100 days.
Yeah, and I suppose there has been a lot of talk this week about the first 100 days because Trump has used this, I think, rather self-defeatingly in some ways as a marker. I think it's fair to say that for a government that were like pretty much one seat shy of an overall majority between them going in, the first 100 days have been extremely lackluster. And I think the roots of that go back to really a pretty terrible deal that they negotiated with the independents, given how strong their hand was going into this. And I think that has contributed. And I think this argy-bargy around housing and around the czar is just reflective of what have been, I think all that piece around the, you know, independence and the politicisation of the Ceann Comhairle and the, you know, being in opposition and being in government, that has led to, I think, quite a tetchiness, that's my feeling, within this particular coalition, and a sense that people are really out to fight and protect their own corner perhaps a bit more than they are in government. I'd also be a bit concerned, given what I feel was a really poor negotiation strategy in the government negotiations and in framing the programme for government, you'd be concerned about their capacity to go out there and navigate what is an enormously complex
international terrain. The Taoiseach was saying no one else wanted to go into government.
To be fair, if you look at basic negotiation strategy, if you have, and I think it's fair to say, you had potentially two entities you could open a conversation with here. Now, leaving my own politics aside, negotiation strategy would suggest you play them off against each other until you get
Labour,
the deal.
But Labour flounced out before there was any...
No. To be fair, I think there was a difference within the coalition parties and who wanted to have that conversation. And I think there were very significant differences between Fianna Fáil and Fine Gael
who in the opposition wanted to have the conversation.
Well, I think Labour went in the door and met them. I think there was a conversation to be had.
I reported
there.
On it all at the time. And
but do you not think, Pat, that Micheál Martin making it so explicit early on that he in particular wanted to do a deal with the independents, significantly weakened their hand when they went in to do that deal and meant that they gave them more than probably they should have given them, given the numbers that they had?
I think they certainly didn't realise.
I mean, they could have got a much better deal than they did.
They didn't realise the sort of reaction that the change to Dáil speaking arrangements that the independents made one of their conditions for doing it. They certainly didn't realise the impact that was going to have and how that would kind of colour the whole first.
Yeah, and I think that's the point. I think that has coloured.
But on the point of whether
days.
You know there was going to be a deal, whether there was going to be a coalition deal between Fianna Fáil, Fine Gael and independents, I think that was very clear from the days after the election when the numbers became clear.
Okay.
And Labour and Social Democrats did lots of performative things.
Let's come back to the bread and butter of what all this means for people. A sobering piece by Wayne O'Connor in the Sunday Independent today, and I think you all picked this, but Myrne, maybe you tell us about it. Housing targets to be missed again. It looks like, according to fairly credible sounding people he's spoken to there, and counting the first quarter and a very careful count in Dublin of actually what's being built, we're only going to build 30,000 houses again this year potentially.
Yeah, you can get wobbles in the data. You can get things like, you know, kind of there were changes to development levies and that kind of thing, which means you might want to push some of your commencements earlier rather than later. So if you just kind of get a one quarter or one month or something, you wouldn't want to call it a trend. But on the basis of what we have so far, it does look like housing completions are not going to be probably even what they were last year, which itself was falling short of the target and
last year that how many houses were going to be done.
Nobody knows.
I know, but what were your projections? They weren't anywhere near 40,000.
I don't want to speak for my colleagues on the housing on the housing side, but certainly, you know, kind of there were different numbers coming out from different bodies. No one actually knows until the CSO does whatever they do the next year.
Yeah, okay.
And it does seem that there was a kind of I'm a big believer in never attributing to malice what can be attributed to incompetence. And it's no one has a crystal ball. So, but it certainly does seem the case that while we did fall short of the targets, I don't think anyone expected us to fall as short as we did last year. To only do just over 30,000 units.
And now it could look as if there's fewer again.
And it's deeply concerning because one of the huge blockages is just labour shortages, and just the construction sector is so tight at the moment. It's absolutely.
But I thought the construction sector is saying we can. Michael O'Flynn and people say we can build 60,000 houses a year. Just let us do it. Like put the infrastructure there and free up the land and get the planning through.
So it's at capacity right now, and not just in terms of new build of houses. If you look at things like delivery on retrofitting of the existing housing stock, also falling well short of our targets. And then we could import new more construction workers, but then where do they all live? That exacerbates. So the fact that both the housing sector and the construction sector are under such strain right now, there are hard limits on how many units we can deliver per year.
And Dan, this is just 1 second. This is kind of catastrophic for them if they actually, if there are fewer, I won't say they build because the government doesn't build the houses. If there are fewer houses built again this year, Like, as Pat's saying, the signal and the noise. Forget all the noise this week, like, but that's the fundamental issue that they will stand or fall on, isn't it?
Yeah, my fear is that this will just increase the level of disenchantment you can see out there. I mean, I get a lot of it on social media these days, and a lot of it comes down to complaints about I will never be able to afford a house. When am I going to get out of my own house? There's all these figures about the number of people who are living at home with their parents much older than you would normally expect. There's suggestions of emigration. Although, mind you, in the Australian election this week, the big issues were housing, affordability and availability of housing and healthcare. So there's not necessarily any nirvana there.
Pat, you want
to... No, I'm just going to make the same point that this will translate, I think, into a very big political problem for the government, which will endure throughout the entire 5 years of it. And I sort of think that the two government parties, two main government parties, got a bit of a pass at the last election. They were talking about that made progress, they were going to do 40,000 houses, etc. last year. That obviously turned out not to be the case. People weren't that convinced by the Sinn Féin offering. I think the calculation will be very different next time, unless the government has some sort of a transformational step change.
Yeah, there'll be no Trump factor either.
I don't see that coming.
And before we go to
I think the report of the Housing Commission said that the fundamental problem with the Irish approach to housing is that it's risk averse and reactive. And until you actually change those two things, we're still going to have a scenario where we have one of the highest spends in the EU and one of the poorest outcomes. So we're actually not saving any money here. And that's the fundamental problem.
OK, we'll take a break. Dan Mulhall, Professor Niamh Horrigan, Pat Leahy and Dr. Muireann Lynch staying with us. Welcome back, Dan Mulhall, Professor Niamh Horrigan, Pat Leahy and Dr. Muireann Lynch still with us. So Professor Niamh Horrigan, with your sociologist hat on, NECAP, the piece you picked is... the front page of the Sunday Times, where NECAP are saying that they are getting a wave of hate mail now. And just bring us up to speed kind of in a nutshell on
okay, so I'm sure many people have been following this because it's all over not only the conventional press but also social media. And, you know, there are comments that NECAP made in Coachella around the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, and that has led to a kind of a rear view, I suppose, looking
at... No, I think just to be clear, I think they did put up F Israel and Free Palestine at Coachella, but I think there were elsewhere stuff was dug up then.
Yes, exactly.
With one of them saying, we support Hamas, we support Hezbollah, and then also from some other gig... there's kill your local MP.
Yes.
There's no such thing as a dead Tory is
correct.
Useless or whatever. Yeah, sorry, I'm
so
paraphrasing.
I suppose a couple of things.
And they have apologised.
They have apologised, and indeed, I think they have said. I think it's the British MP, is that David Lamb. They said they're willing to meet his daughter, who was very upset by those comments, and obviously, I think Joe Cox's husband, who has
also, David Amos.
David Amos. That's it. Yeah. He has already also expressed concerns. A couple of things. I suppose the first thing is my own feeling around this is that there's a very significant generational difference here in my world. I suppose I'm somebody who works with people what I would consider the TikTok generation. My children are the TikTok generation. And to be fair. Well, I think he's an early adopter, Pat. You know, in my age group, I think there's a sense of kind of two-sidism, for want of a better word, where people say, well, it's not a good thing to say those kind of things about politicians, and they're, you know, the piece around the Palestine-Israel is perhaps nuanced. As you move down the younger generations, from my sense of it, it's very much more explicitly kind of on the NECAP side of the debate. And one of the interesting...
OK, let's break down, though, the two things, right? Because, as Eilidh O'Hanlon points out in the Sunday Independent, name me one popular musician who hasn't supported Palestine. Like, it's pretty much the mainstream view. So I don't... Is there an issue there? Like,
well, one of the things that's interesting for me, as somebody
like
who's...
the government?
An old woman at this point, is that, you know, we didn't... You know, it's so long since music and musicians have been in this kind of political space. I mean, in the late 70s, in the era of punk, this would be a nothing, okay? And even in the 90s, in the early era of rap, this would be a nothing.
Well, no, they were some things at the time.
Yes, they
we
were some things at the time.
But Acid House at the time.
So in a sense, this is kind of coming around again. I think, to be fair, Brendan, we sometimes in Ireland, because, but you know, even by European standards, ourselves and Spain are pro-Palestinian in the broader Europe, perhaps more pro-Palestinian than some of our European neighbours are. And in that context, you know, not everybody shares that view and not everybody is going to.
But again, is the problem that they have expressed pro-Palestinian views, or is the problem that they said, we support Hamas, we support Hezbollah, which is slightly different, isn't it?
Well, I suppose that is it. And
that's the problem.
But I suppose where if you look at the coverage on, say, TikTok and social media, that distinction, I don't think is there to the same extent.
The thing is, I think, is there a fundamental misunderstanding with NICAP about where the line is between it being some kind of a parody or an ironic kind of, you know, repurposing of an in inverted commas reflection of, say, the nationalist, ultra-nationalist kind of culture of Northern Ireland, and whether they mean it or not. It's a fiction in one way, NICAP, isn't it, Pat? You know what I'm saying?
We're at the very edge of my knowledge of popular culture here now.
You know what I mean? But like, I know they are playing a part, and they are, you know, provocateurs who are playing around with the iconography of various things.
Yeah. The other view, I suppose, is that when somebody says "up Hamas, up Hezbollah," that's what they mean, and is taken by their audience.
But they have said it's not what they mean.
Well, then we'll have to take their word for it, if you like.
Or, I suppose the question is, can both things be true at the same time?
Yeah.
But there is a
difference. I don't find myself going around saying "up cork" by mistake. In an ironic sort of way. You know.
So do you think there a bit of a hop on them, or is this just like
they're doing a lot of complaining about it. There is clearly a bit of a pile on the moment of people going back through old footage of them, as they say. But that's what happens when you enter into the contested space of politics. You know, people have different views, very deeply held different views, and they're not playing around. People who are dealing with these sort of life and death issues, they're not playing around with the iconography. They mean what they say. And if you jump into that space, then
put on your big boy pants, like,
exactly, you can expect
with you.
You can expect, and don't start whinging about it then.
Yeah, Dan.
I mean, look, there is a fundamental difference between being sympathetic to the Palestinian cause, which most people are in Ireland and beyond, and supporting Hamas, which clearly engaged in an atrocious terrorist act against Israel. But I think my own view is that these are young performers, right? The Rolling Stones were arrested in the 1960s and, you know, brought to trial for things that turned out to be nothing really. And it's happened. I mean, remember Paul McCartney published or wrote this song, "Give Ireland Back to the Irish," created a huge stir. So this is nothing new. What I think is new is the social media thing, where everything is out there. Everything can be brought back into focus and taken out of context. And of course, you know.
So are you saying, Dan, as a boomer, like that
thank you.
You allow artists space to make mistakes, maybe to push the line sometimes. We see it a lot with comedy
I'm an old-fashioned liberal, so I'm okay with all these things. But today, not everyone is. And there's clearly a move against this kind of old-fashioned liberalism.
And the local MP thing, like,
didn't mean to tell people
to go out and do it, but is it irresponsible?
That was stupidity, right? I mean, to say things like that is crazy, given that in recent memory, two British MPs have been killed. That was a very silly thing to say, and I'm sure they've apologised for it. But I do think that the piling on has to do with the fact that the whole atmosphere of public life has shifted in a direction that goes against this kind of openness and this kind of liberal sort of, you know, say whatever you like, everything is fine. I mean, you know, in America they talk about, you know, free speech, but it seems to be only free speech when people in power agree with what you're saying, rather than, you know, free speech as a kind of a principle. So I think it's unfortunate they've been piled in on, and I think they, you know, they need to kind of calm it down, they need to go quiet for a while and maybe try to rebuild their reputation. But ultimately, they are very young people, they're young artists. I mean, I remember when the Irish women's soccer team sang a song after they qualified for the World Cup. It was a huge pile on them. My attitude at the time was that, you know, these are, you know, young athletes. They've had a great success and they got a bit exuberant and they said things that they shouldn't have said. They sang a song they shouldn't probably
sung. And equally, very, very offensive to a lot of people.
Yeah, of course, yeah. So I mean, you know, I mean, the offense is there. But unfortunately, I think in the current climate, these kind of things get blown up out of all proportion and you get this kind of almost a fatwa against niqab at the moment. And I can see that in across the media and particularly on social media where they're being kind of demonised, which I think is unfortunate. I think
there's a huge amount of support for them in the artistic
I think it depends on your echo chamber.
No, look, I mean, obviously, but I mean, you know, they are being hit hard and, you know, their tour to America, I think, has been cancelled. They're going to have difficulty getting gigs and so forth.
Yeah.
So, you know, they've suffered and I think they just need to manage this thing and you know, for their point of view, hopefully get through it and, you know, and resume and maybe...
So in the grand scheme of these things, they might take a little bit of time out to reflect.
Maybe they'll be older and wiser next time they kind of come to public attention.
I think though, Brendan, like what the internet has done is it's enabled a new playbook, which is someone says something you disagree with. So you go and find something else they said that everybody disagrees with and you publicise that. Mm. And it's just a really nifty way of taking down anyone. I mean, every now and again, you know, I get something pops up on social media that I posted 10 years ago and it's like, oh, share this with your friends. And I'm like, good God, no, I was an obnoxious idiot 10 years ago. What was I thinking saying that? And the fact that we all have our entire
good
past
Lord,
lives.
What were you saying 10 years ago?
Okay. Anyway, there are more important things going on in the world. Niamh, will you just tell us about the Australian elections? We've seen the anti-Trump bump there which people are taking heart
from. I think it's
from.
Probably the story of this week, really, is looking at how international politics is reacting to Trump and essentially kind of, you could almost, I saw someone describe it yesterday as like the grown-ups essentially reconverging. And what we've seen is a significant bump from the Liberals and Mark Carney in Canada, mm-hmm. and also a bump for Albanese in Australia. Very, very interesting. And it's interesting in light of the fact that Trump's three challenges in his next 100 days are going to be, he's facing a showdown with the courts. There's no question about it. It's going to happen in the next 100 days. He's facing a showdown with Congress in terms of getting his spending through, which I think some of the Republicans will even balk at. And then this whole, which was the mirage which underpinned Brexit as well, this idea that we can do all this crazy economic policy and then we're going to go out there and negotiate all these deals in an instant, which is going to make it all worthwhile. I mean, even if you look at that mineral deal with Ukraine, it's significantly different from the original one that they published. The Ukrainians obviously understand a bit about the art of the deal as well. And the idea...
I think the less we say about that minerals deal, in case the Americans are listening, but like, well done the Ukrainians. So Dan, we've seen Canada and Australia. We took great heart in that. It's funny Niamh mentions the UK, where they have not clearly learned any lessons from Brexit, where they are kind of going more Trumpy, you might say, in their elections this week.
On Australia, first of all, I spent time there in the 1980s. My wife's Australian, so I've been there quite a lot. So I've followed Australian politics over the years. And you know, since 2004, no prime minister has ever been re-elected. So this is the first time in 18 years. There have been six prime ministers since John Howard was re-elected in 2004. And so every time the Australians seem to want to change their prime minister. And this time around, if you look at the opinion polls, in January of this year, the Liberals were 10% ahead of Labour. Labour were heading for a wipeout. And instead, the Liberals were wiped out and their leader lost his seat because he was seen as a kind of a mini Trump. So, yes, you're right. The opposite has happened. We've had the leftish-leaning candidates winning in Canada and in Australia. And in Britain, you've had, or in England, certainly, you've had a surge on reform. And, you know, they got 31% of the vote. Now, it has to be taken with a pinch of salt because these were all rural county councils. There were no urban votes counted. Labour strongholds weren't really affected. Labour was an also-ran in most of the councils there. But still, you know, 31% of those who voted for reform. If that were to happen in a general election, you could conceivably have reform in government. And that would be a huge challenge for Ireland. Imagine Nigel Farage as Prime Minister. How would the reset of relations go at that stage? I mean,
I saw an interesting piece about Mark Carney. Janan Ganesh is a great columnist writing that. He's a liberal, but who talks the talk of the kind of populist playbook, like that he was fighty, he wasn't a wet, woke-looking liberal or anything, that he felt like, you know, he's the daddy, the people trust him and everything. It's an interesting kind of thing, isn't it, Niamh?
Yeah, and even his speech, I don't know if any of you saw his acceptance speech, and it had the feel of like a Trump town hall, and you had people shouting out in the audience going, you're going to fix this, Mark, and it's all going to be great. But one of the most interesting...
So we could, if people could put a bit of muscle into liberalism, like they could make liberalism great again.
They could. But the interesting thing about the reform vote, Brendan, if you drill into, you know, the question of why people voted reform, you know, the number one issue that keeps coming up is immigration. And Brexit was supposed to solve that. Mm-hmm. And immigration, you could argue now, is a bigger problem for them now than it was when they were part of the EU.
But I saw John Curtis was the leading sophologist in Britain. He looked at the vote from this week and he compared it with the Brexit vote. And he showed that reform did best where there was most support for Brexit back at the time of the referendum. So this looks like the return of Brexit.
Without Brexit.
It's also evidence of a growing structural change in British politics. Mm. And, you know, we've seen that here to an extent as well. And other European countries are seeing it as well, where they're just moving away from that two and a half party system, which they've had, into a much more multipolar system. There's going to be 5-6 substantial parties at the next general election. The difficulty for British governance in the future is that their electoral system is wholly ill-equipped to deal with that. And I think that makes the future of British politics hugely unpredictable.
Is this because first past the post, gives it, if you win by one in a load of constituencies, you essentially get a landslide?
So even though they've had like the Liberal Democrats as the half party in their system, essentially outside of, you know, the regions in England, their system is set up for a two-party competition. Even in those places where the Liberal Democrats, it tends to be Liberal Democrats versus Conservatives or Liberal Democrats versus Labour.
But I suppose the question is, because this is a second-tier election, if in a general election it will revert back to a two-part system where you have seen that pattern before in the UK where two parties tend to reassert themselves in the big day. You know?
And there's also the fact that reform will now be running quite a number of councils in Britain. I'd be watching to see just how they do when they actually have responsibility. So far, they've just been a party of, you know,
they will now
slogans
have a record.
And so now they have to do something.
Yeah.
And this is going to leave them with a mixed record and probably a rather negative record if I have any insight into
Dan,
on the
US
people.
Itself, tell us about this story. It's on the front of the Irish Mirror today, Tragic and Cruel on the Undocumented Irish by Lynn Kelleher. This immigration lawyer, Brian O'Dwyer.
Yeah.
If this is true, like, it sounds pretty ominous, doesn't it?
Well, there've always been a small number of deportations of Irish people every year. I used to get the figures when I was.
So, what is deferred action? What does it
deferred action is where you're found to be illegally in the United States, but because you're maybe married to a U.S. citizen and you're on the road to getting a green card or getting citizenship, you're kind of, you know, they don't expel you right away. But the problem now is I don't think that the ICE are going after Irish people specifically, but they're obviously interested in upping their numbers. So if they come across someone that falls into their net, then I think they're going to take advantage of that and put them in as a figure as one of their achievements. So look, it's a very rough situation. No one knows how many Irish documented there are in the United States, but it's certainly not an insignificant number. The numbers probably come down in recent times, but given the changed atmosphere now and given the way in which immigration is being handled in the United States now and the very tough and unrelenting approach taken by the Trump administration, you know, I wouldn't like to be an Irish undocumented person at the moment, because you'd have to fear that there's a reasonable chance that at some stage in the next few years you're going to fall into the net and find yourself himself incarcerated and maybe put on a plane home. Now, I don't think any of the Irish are going to end up in El Salvador. I'm not suggesting that. But certainly, and I mean, I know all the people quoted in that story, Jim Cavanaugh, who's a lawyer in Nebraska, and then Fiona McEntee, who's a very good immigration lawyer in Chicago. And, you know, the Irish have a lot of support systems. All of the Irish immigration centres across the United States are funded by the Department of Foreign Affairs, and they have good lawyers who can advise and act for people. But it's certainly a much more difficult situation now than it was even during the first Trump administration, when the numbers of Irish people who were deported was really very small. It was probably in the sort of 20 or 30 a year. So it was almost people who almost accidentally got deported.
I think it has become visceral for people in the US in a way that it simply wasn't, certainly for the Irish before. I was over there for covering the St. Patrick's Day trip over there, and I was at a St. Patrick's Day thing there at a house of a friend of mine, and they, you know, these were classic Georgetown academics, think tankers, people who worked politics and journalism, and it was all they spoke about.
Yeah, really,
the fear that people they knew were going to be, and in reality, where a lot of them were talking about people, you know, who were their nannies, their cleaners, their childminders, that sort of thing. And these people, of many of them of questionable immigration status, were terrified that they were going to be picked up.
You'd be concerned as well about youngsters going on J1s because they frequently run into the law at a low level. And I'd be very concerned about that.
On America and our relationship with America, will you just tell us briefly about the $967 billion tax mirage on the front of the Business Post? Can you explain it in English, the vulnerability that this might give us?
Yeah, so what it's talking about intangible assets, which includes IP, and the point of an intangible asset is, in and of itself, it's useless. It's only useful because it lets you do something else, and IP is the classic example. Now, we've known for a good while that an awful lot of American companies base their IP in Ireland. But what this story shows us is the extent of that, and also the extent to which it's concentrated in a very small number of firms. So the big fear, I suppose, is the IP is here not really for Irish tax reasons. Those loopholes were closed a good while ago. It's more on the American side of things that it's in these companies' interest to locate their IP in Irish companies.
Okay. But the big fear is, could a stroke of a pen in America change things radically?
Potentially, yeah. And then the thing is, if that stroke of the pen in America leads to these companies just pulling out of Ireland in general, then there goes a huge chunk of the corporation tax reserves, and then you put that on top of the threat of tariffs, and it just goes to underline once again how really vulnerable these revenues are, how we really can't count on them going forwards. Now, people are saying that this sounds like the boy who cried wolf, but the actual
economic activity that is going on by American corporations in this country is only a small part of what is earning all our corporation tax. A lot of it is clearly this $1 trillion in IP, which is taking royalty payments and whatever else from all over the world.
Look, nothing continues forever. The Industrial Revolution, we weren't part of it. Nobody planned it, it happened. The technological revolution, the era of globalization, all those things happened. And we're now at a point when things are changing. And we have to be aware of those changes, and we have to accommodate those changes, and we have to find a way of navigating a way for Ireland through these changes. But the fact is, there are still 800 American companies who are doing real things in Ireland. They're actually generating profit and revenue in Ireland. And people talk about the tax that we receive from American companies. We charge 15% tax, corporation tax. That means that seven times that amount of money is being transferred back to the United States to the benefit of those companies. They don't want to lose that profit that they are benefiting from.
I hope you're right. Pat, quickly, and we take a break.
Yeah, just on this point, I don't think people kind of realise the extent to which this could change relatively quickly. And not that the economic activity is going to collapse, but the tax payments, which have given us this extraordinary boom in corporation tax payments over the last 10 years. It's relatively recent. That could go. That's what has funded the three 10 billion euro giveaway budgets that we've had for the last year, for the last 3 years. And without that, you know, our politics and the fortunes of this government, I think, look very difficult. As Muireann says, you know, people have been accusing Department of Finance, has been warning about this for years, of being, you know, the boy who cried wolf. The whole point of this story about the boy who cried wolf is that the wolf turns up in the end.
All right, we'll take a break. Dan Mulhall, Niamh Horrigan, Pat Leahy and Dr. Muireann Lynch staying with us. Welcome back, Dan Mulhall, Professor Niamh Horrigan, Pat Leahy and Dr. Muireann Lynch still with us. So, Dr. Muireann Lynch, you are energy specialist, right? So, basically, there's now a culture war over what happened and the power outages in Spain, Portugal and a bit of France during the week. And there does seem to be, like I'm reading in reputable media and high-end media, that renewables was part of what tripped off the kind of equilibrium of the grid here, that renewables are less reliable maybe in a grid situation.
So what happened in Spain and Portugal is a power system engineer's worst nightmare. It's so scary, it's got a really scary name called a cascading failure. I was chatting to a friend during the week and he was like, that sounds like my life, you know, cascading failure. But what the thing is, this is the scenario that absolutely everything in the power system is arranged around trying to avoid. So when you have a cascading failure, it will never ever be because one thing went wrong. It's always going to be because a lot of things went wrong at the same time and you got unlucky. So the idea that it's due to renewables is nonsense. It's not due to any one thing, because if it was, we'd see cascading failures all the time, and we don't. However, it certainly is the case that extra renewables on the system can make these events a little bit more likely. But we've known that for decades. You know, it is not news.
Is it an argument that we do need more backup traditional legacy sources of power still though there? Because I didn't realise how delicate grids are. Like, it's like your house. Like, this, if there's a surge, the whole thing trips kind of thing, yeah?
So we do need backup thermal generation. We've known that for a long time, and we have a lot of systems in place to make sure that happens. Those systems in Ireland are not working very well, but that's a separate story. Then what happened in Spain and Portugal is nothing to do with did we have enough gas generators. It's to do with the stability of the system.
So do we need some kind of transformer between the renewables and the grid? Is that the thing like that?
What we need is what's called system services. So basically, we need stuff that doesn't just pump out energy into the grid. We need stuff that can respond super quickly to a change. If one thing trips off, we need something else that can come on within 200 milliseconds. And we have that.
Do we have it in Ireland?
Yeah. So in Ireland, what we have is a really, really sophisticated set of what are called system services. And other countries and other power systems are actually learning from us. And the reason for that is because we're small. So you can think of it like... You think of it like a bath, okay? You've got like a whole load of taps flowing in and you've a whole load of drains coming out.
Okay.
The taps coming in are the generators, the drains coming out is the demand. The power system operator's job is to keep the level of water in the bath constant. If it goes too high or too low, that's when everything trips. Now, if you can think of your kitchen sink, if you had five taps coming into your kitchen sink and five drains coming out of your kitchen sink, all it takes is one of those taps or drains to go a little bit off and the level of water changes very, very quickly. On the other hand, if you have a great big swimming pool and five taps going into the swimming pool and five drains coming out, one of the drains or one of the taps goes off and you actually have a good bit of time before the level of water in the swimming pool becomes a problem. So the smaller systems are actually much better at dealing with these events because we see them more frequently.
Well, listen, that was all worth it to hear something that Ireland is actually a world leader.
There you go.
When it comes to anything. Okay, excellent. Pat, I know you were very keen to talk about the twin family tragedies of the Brooklands and the Windsors.
If you thought that cascading failures in the energy system was bad, just wait until you hear about this. So both the Beckhams and the Windsors, it appears, are estranged from their sons. Oh. Prince Harry has issued a plea to reconcile with his father. But sources close to his father have told the Mail, where else, that he can't reconcile with them. He can't have a private conversation with them because he thinks it might end up on the news that evening.
You see, I feel like a fool now because I watched Harry, right, unmediated by the Mail and people like that, and I kind of started seeing his point. Then I read the papers and realised that the whole interview was outrageous.
Yeah,
and
but if
a
you're making a plea to
family.
Talk to your dad and that plea is on a BBC interview at 5 o'clock on a Friday evening, maybe that's not the way to do it, Brendan, to be fair.
Yeah. Well, maybe the way to answer is not through the Daily Mail either, sure. Or through the family issuing statements. So anyway, that's
but
them.
As if that wasn't bad enough.
Britain's unofficial royal family, the Beckhams.
Indeed, the Beckhams, it seems, are estranged from their eldest son, whose name is Brooklyn. And so he's got married. It appears that his wife, because she didn't
Nicole Peltz.
Thank you. She didn't wear a wedding gown designed by David Beckham's wife, who does such things, that there's been a bit of a rift in the family.
David Beckham's wife has a name. Posh Spice is her name. Victoria Beckham.
Ms. Spice.
Now, that had been cleared up as far as I knew.
No. Now, do you know how many family events that Brooklyn and his wife, Nicola, have missed so far this year?
Well, David Beckham seems
quite a lot of family events.
David Beckham has had 12 50th birthday parties already this week.
This week they failed to turn up. The Beckhams flew off to Bordeaux, where they had lunch in Chateau Petrus, very nice, and then they went for dinner in Paris later that evening, and then they came back to London for another dinner. All these people seem to do is fly around and eat. Maybe it's that sort of unhealthy behaviour.
It's his birthday, isn't that what we all do on our birthday?
Yeah. Yeah, but seriously though,
Dan, as a diplomat, could you bring any peace to any of these situations?
I do feel sorry for Prince Harry in that, but he's been very badly advised, and the idea of being angry and then going on to a BBC interview and sort of letting fly is obviously not a good idea. I mean, I saw Queen Elizabeth's cousins and their role, and I thought if I were Harry, I'd want to avoid that role for the future for myself. But I think he's handled it very badly. Whoever's advising him needs to be fired, and he needs to find new advisors.
That sounds like a come and get me plea there from Dan Mulhall.
Okay. Surely,
yeah. Dan Mulhall, former Irish ambassador to the US, Professor Niamh Horrigan, Vice President of Academic Affairs at Mary Immaculate College, Pat Leahy, political editor of the Irish Times, and Dr. Merlin Lynch, Senior Research Officer with the ESRI. Thank you all so much.